This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Hey there, it's Jordan Hoffman, host of Engage, the official Star Trek podcast. And you can join me and all the Trekkies, Trekkers, and Trek Curious at Star Trek Mission New York this Labor Day weekend, September 2nd through the 4th, 2016. Head over to cbs.com/Star Trek and enter for your chance to win a trip to New York City and tickets to one of the top Star Trek events in the galaxy.
Space, the final frontier.
These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission to explore strange new worlds.
Boldly go where no man has gone before.
Engage.
Kirk Enterprise,
This is Captain Jean-Luc Picard.
Captain Janeway.
Captain Sisko.
Red alert.
Photon torpedoes, fire.
The official Star Trek podcast.
Engage.
Make it so.
With your host, Jordan Hoffman.
That, sir, is illogical.
And to make sure, history never forgets.
This is Engage.
Hailing frequencies open, sir.
And we're back.
Hey,
and we're here. Oh, man, this is going to be a really fun episode of Engage. Wait, I haven't introduced you yet.
Oh, okay.
We have a special guest because we are pre-gaming right now. We're at the Emerald Inn on West 72nd Street in Manhattan. We're about to go to the IMAX Theater on West 68th. So that's four blocks away, to see the Star Trek Marathon. We're going to see Star Trek 09, Star Trek Into Darkness, and then for the first time in public, the first public screenings of Star Trek Beyond. And I have a guest with me, a mystery man.
Whoa.
We're calling him only by one name, and that name is Frito.
You can call me by other names.
I'm going to call you Frito.
There are people who have called me names that I can't say on this podcast.
We've got Frito on the show today. P-H-R-I-E-D-O.
Something like that.
Or is it F-R-I-E-D-O?
That's you can find me on the Twitters on that name.
Okay, F-R-I-E-D-O. Frito at Frito.org.
com. I'm a profitable business.
Who is Frito, you're wondering? Frito is a Star Trek fan. I found him. There's one of them here in New York City. Frito is a Star Trek fan, and he is going to be my partner in crime for this afternoon into this evening as we watch these three movies in a row. Let me ask you, Frito, when did you first become a Star Trek fan?
I became a Star Trek fan because my father was a science fiction fan, and he was a big fan of the original series. I was born in 1981, so TNG came around, I think, 1988, right?
87.
I'm like 6-7 years old. And so my dad and I, Saturday nights, it was syndicated WPIX here in New York, and we would watch Star Trek The Next Generation. And that was a very nice bonding kind of ritual that we had. And we would also watch reruns of the original series and so on. And, you know, he loved science fiction ever since he was a kid. He introduced me to, you know, authors like Heinlein and Asimov and Arthur C. Clarke. And so this is something that we really had in common. And then Deep Space Nine came along in 92, 93, around there sometime.
Yeah, sometime.
And then Voyager finished up sometime, I guess I was in like my early 20s.
And you were loving that all, and then Enterprise came.
And I was loving that all. I like Enterprise fine.
I like Enterprise too.
I'm not in love with Enterprise, but it has its moments. But
we were just talking before we started recording. You were shoveling shit about Enterprise.
Right, but I'm being polite because we're on the air now.
How would a Star Trek manifest itself in your day-to-day? Is there a day that goes by that you don't think about Star Trek in some capacity?
A day that I don't think about... there's always moments from Star Trek that are popping into my mind and always sort of little character details, especially when I'm working, and I'm a software engineer, so I'm constantly trying to figure out.
Like I said, you're a Star Trek fan.
Right. So I'm constantly trying to figure out problems, and, you know, often there's, you know, some Scotty or Geordi line will pop into my head or something like that. There are days, sadly, when I don't get to watch Star Trek. But it is always in kind of the back of my mind, the way a lot of things are, because it was such a big part of my childhood.
Has anything, was there a moment where you realized that your fandom for this property was above and beyond other things? Was it when you were reading the novels, or when you were collecting, did you collect Star Trek things? Or,
I don't really have any Star Trek things. I have read a very large number of Star Trek books. I think one moment I remember, I was around, I think maybe 12 or 13, and one of the Next Generation technical manuals came out. I think it was Mike Okuda wrote the Enterprise technical manual or something like that. And my dad saw it and picked it up, and I remember spending the entire weekend just reading every page of that. And at the time, I'm thinking kind of two things at once. I'm like, one, this is awesome, and that's how that works, and that makes any sense. And at the other time, I'm thinking, wow, these guys put a lot of effort into making all of this up. You know, this is, you know, it's one thing to have an actual spaceship and write the manual for it, but they made this up. And
just in case, it does start working, they got to come
right,
back.
Yeah, and you know, just in case. You know, Galaxy Quest is a real thing. You have to have the technical manual there. But I remember being kind of amazed by that and thinking, like, how cool would it be if that was your job? If it was, you know, if it was your job to invent a fictional spaceship and say, you know, well, here's how warp travel might work.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking that was very cool. And that was sort of one of the many formative things that got me really interested in technology and computers and learning how to write software and program and do math and all of that sort of stuff.
It made you the Frito that you are today.
It was definitely one of the principal ingredients in the Frito stew.
Awesome. Well, listen, so we're going to head over in a little bit to the theater. We're having a few
Romulan ales.
A few Romulan ales beforehand, even though it's the middle of the day.
Some spring wine, maybe.
The first show starts at 4:30. We're going to kick right into Star Trek 09, as they call it. And I got to say, I've seen this movie a lot of times.
Yeah.
I saw it maybe five times in the theater. Actually, it might have been six. And then I've seen it many times on Blu-ray since, but it's been a while, and I love it to pieces. Even though it doesn't, if you haven't read the tie-in comics, it doesn't make sense about where Nero was for 20 years.
Right.
But
I have not read those comics, so maybe
so you
can
still
explain
don't know.
To me. I don't.
He was on Rurapente.
Oh, okay, I think I heard that, but I read that somewhere, but I haven't read
it. I think I might have told you. I would have screamed it at you in a drunken rage one night.
That could very well be.
All right. Well, listen. So we're gonna watch. We're gonna head over to theater, and then we're gonna kick it off with the way they're doing it at this marathon all across North America. Is at 4:30 p.m. There's the 09, and then there's about a half hour break, just enough time to go and run and buy some milk duds. We're gonna go to the store and not pay the prices at AMC theaters.
Right.
It's ridiculous, the prices there. So we're going to sneak in some Junior Mints or Milk Duds or...
Hey, whatever floats your boat, man.
What about like a... You know what I like? They're not Juju Fruits. They're called Dots. Do you know Dots?
Yeah, I know Dots.
Dots are... They're terrible for your teeth, but they're pretty good.
Yeah.
I think... And they're not as bad for you as Milk Duds.
I mean, it's basically pure sugar, but...
Yeah, but it's... I think the fat content is a little lower.
Maybe we could get some replicated Dots with artificial sweeteners. I don't know.
Maybe a box of Dots and...
This is what your fans want, by the way.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry.
Is deliberations over candy. Don't apologize, because this is fascinating.
I forgot that I was
This
recording.
Is the best part of the
I was
whole conversation.
Totally in my own head. Should I get Dots or should I get Junior Mints? Are we going to get something? And then... we're going to take a break, and then we got to face facts here. I've already seen Star Trek Beyond. You have
right.
not.
I have not.
I've seen it. I like it a lot. I love it. I don't love every moment of it, but I love it.
Okay.
But we do have to face facts that we are going to be seeing for the first time in a long time, Star Trek Into Darkness together.
Right.
Which you like more than me.
Yeah, I mean, it's not my favorite thing, but I have I have defended aspects of it in the way that I've defended aspects of Star Trek V.
Star Trek, I love, yes, yes, I'm with you there. Okay, cool. So we're going to see you back in a little bit, and we'll take it from there.
Engage. Engage.
Matt Singer, let me ask you a question. How comfortable are you right now?
You mean like politically, socially?
I mean in terms of physical comfort in your lower region.
I mean, I'm fairly comfortable, but I could always be more comfortable,
Jordan. Let me tell you something.
Okay.
If you were wise enough, if you had the wisdom of Spock and Surak and the guts of Worf to make it so, I just mixed so many Star Trek metaphors there. You would change whatever undergarments you're wearing right now in front of me to Mack Weldon underwear.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Do you know about Mack Weldon underwear?
I've heard about it on your podcast.
Well, I'll say this about it.
Okay.
It costs a little bit more than regular underwear.
There's a butt coming.
There's
and
a
not
butt.
Just in the underwear, I can tell.
It does cost a little bit more. But you know what they say? You get what you pay for.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And this is the most comfortable underwear I have ever worn. It's silky smooth. I feel like I am being held aloft by a cloud. That's how comfortable I am in my underwear right now.
You could sit through all of Star Trek the Motion Picture without getting any sense of discomfort.
No.
And it's a long film.
It conforms to your shape.
Thanks to your underwear.
Regardless, and if you are a Star Trek fan like me, your shape could be on the larger size and it'll still conform to your shape. And Mack Weldon has a line of underwear, and I swear this is true, called the Silver Line. And it is made with these advanced microbes that contain odor within them. I'm not saying that you have this issue.
I hope you're not.
And if you did, that's fine. IDIC, I welcome all sorts of individuals that have different capabilities in their person. So if you are someone who has an issue with odor that could sometimes cause awkward social situations, what you need to do is wear Mack Weldon's silver underwear, because it will, and I'm not joking, like the Enterprise's deflector shields themselves, create a barrier between your stink and the outside world. It's true, Brian. It's true, right?
It's very true.
I mean, we have been sitting here for a while, and I don't smell anything. So,
Matt, and you can thank.
And that's not always true with you, Jordan. Let's
no,
be honest.
It can sometimes be a revolting thing to be in a small room with me for a period of time.
And this is a delight.
This is a delight, and we're
not in a big room.
There's a small room.
It's not well ventilated.
It's not well ventilated. You can thank our friends at Mack Weldon. So go to MackWeldon.com.
I appreciate what they've done for your life.
Use the passcode ENGAGE, and you're going to get 20% off.
Hey, now.
Matt, do you know what they say about 20% off?
It's twice as much as 10% off?
It's still 80% on, actually. But no, it's, you're right. It's more than, it's still a significant percentage off. Go to Mack Weldon, check it out. You're going to love it.
Welcome back to Engage.
Engage.
The official Star Trek podcast with your host, Jordan Hoffman.
You are, after all, irrational.
And we're back. How about that? We are here at the 68th Street AMC Theaters, and my shoe, the bottom of my left foot, is covered in gum. It's
that's
disgusting.
That's part of the 3D experience. I think they call that 4D.
Well, listen, we were hoping that we would talk in between each film, but they botched the timing. So Star Trek 09 pretty much went straight into Star Trek Into Darkness. So there was a moment of elation that I had after the first film, because I love that movie so much. I think it's a miracle how it all worked out. And then we went right into Star Trek Into Darkness. But before we talk about Star Trek Into Darkness, I do want to say, it's funny, now that it's been years, it's been 7 years since
right.
2009, it's almost funny, there was a moment, like, it's amazing to think what this movie could have been.
Oh, it could have been a disaster.
Right, it really... They
it, very, it very easily could have been a disaster.
Yeah, the way they blended... the real timeline, the prime timeline, and the Kelvin timeline, and the way they, the casting of all the characters, the way they, sort of rhymed with canon, as they used to say, it really is a miracle of modern franchise building. I don't think anybody's ever done it better and anybody ever will.
My initial reaction, and I think my feelings have softened in the near decade since the original release, was that I found the Time Paradox introduction of the new universe to be unnecessary and annoying. And I always said, if you're going to reboot the franchise, just do a reboot like everybody else does. You don't have to come up with a temporal paradox.
Do you still feel that way?
I don't feel that way anymore.
Because
I think my feelings about it were reactionary at first. And the reason I don't feel that way anymore is because introducing that timeline allows you to carry over small elements from the Prime universe, like our friend Mr. Spock.
That's the brilliant move. That's
right.
The move that
and
cannot
so
be overstated.
I now see that for the genius that it was, and I appreciate Star Trek 09 a lot more having seen it again, because I haven't seen it in at least 4 or 5 years, I think.
That's a while, yeah.
Because I saw it a couple times when it was out, and I watched it on demand or something once or twice, but it's been a while. And so I think I appreciate it more upon this viewing than I did when I originally saw it.
I'll tell you one thing that's funny. If you sit as we are sitting on the fourth row of the IMAX screen,
yeah,
it's going to give you a little bit of a headache. I screwed up. I specifically wanted to sit in the back, and when we pre-ordered the tickets, but I was looking at it backwards. So
you were looking at the diagram backwards?
I was looking at the diagram backwards, so I have to apologize to you because I put us up front, but it all ultimately worked out. There were a couple things that I never noticed tonight watching Star Trek 09. Number one, tell me if I'm wrong, because you're a smart guy.
Well,
the only reason that the Enterprise survived the attack at Vulcan when Nero's ship destroyed the rest of the Armada,
right,
was because they got there 1 or 2 minutes late.
Yes.
And it's a double whammy. It was that initially you think it's because Kirk's running around, he gets to Pike, and Uhura backs him up and says, "No, we know there's going to be
there's going to
be attack, so let's get into battle formation."
Right, and they basically get there by the time the battle is over.
Right. But also their guard is up, literally. Like he says, "Shields up, red alert," and then they get into battle and they take evasive maneuvers. In the 17 times I've watched it, I've always attributed to their safety due to the fact that Kirk hears lightning storm in space, he races up there, and Uhura gets his back. There's something else to it.
Wait.
This is what I noticed tonight for the first time. The real reason they survived is because Sulu screws up.
Yeah, he's got the parking brake on.
Right. No, if Sulu, maybe, so people have noticed this before, and I'm just a schmuck for never having noticed it, but I get so overwhelmed in the story. I'm so in the moment. I'm such at warp speed with the story that I didn't realize. Had Sulu not screwed up, there's no way they would have survived that ambush.
Yeah, well, they still would have been going in hot with their shields up and everything, so they might have gotten through it, but probably not.
There would have been more casualties.
Yeah.
So Sulu's error, because he redeems himself very quickly on the drill, you know, with his sword and everything. It's a great moment, and he's terrific in the rest of the movie, and he's great in Into Darkness also in the few scenes he has. So I don't want to you know, paint him as if he's some sort of bad, you know, helmsman. But he does make a key error, but it's fortuitous.
And it ties into the theme of the Time Paradox plot as well, which is that, you know, your future is what it's going to be, and you can't second guess yourself and try to affect things based on knowledge you have. Things are just going to work how they're going to work.
I like that.
And it's a thematic moment that sort of ties the whole thing together.
Something else I thought about.
That might have been extraordinarily pretentious, but I don't think so.
Something else that's probably pretty obvious. It was probably obvious to people who watched this movie that weren't Star Trek fans. When you see Kirk doing the Kobayashi Maru.
Yeah.
To us, who know the Kobayashi Maru from Star Trek II, we know that he's going to cheat, and it's in his nature to not accept the no-win scenario.
Right.
What I thought about tonight for the first time is his motivation is twofold. It's not just the typical Kirk swagger. He's really, in a way, trying to one-up the ghost of his dead father. because his father faced something of a Kobayashi Maru scenario on the Kelvin.
It was a no-win scenario.
Right. And he...
And Spock even says it's a no-win scenario when he references Kirk's father at his Inquisition.
Right, right. But there's a little bit of, I think, anger in Chris Pine's performance in that, in addition to the usual I'm the cock of the walk, a little bit of anger. And I think that's him angry at his father.
There's a lot of anger in the Abrams version of the franchise, because it's in Spock, too.
Yes.
Regarding the way he was treated as a halfling and in his childhood. And there's a lot of really intense motivation that I don't think you get with the original Roddenberry characters.
I think the source material is all there, but they spice it up considerably.
Right. It's come everything about the source material is coming from a somewhat darker place than we're used to with Star Trek. And I think that fact is among the things that informed my initial reaction in 2009 when I started seeing this and started saying, this is really not the Star Trek I know. And these are not the 23rd century humans that I have come to know and respect. These guys are kind of jerks. And I think that initial backlash is somewhat justified, but I think overall as a film, if you're judging it on its own merits as its own little thing, it is a good film, and it's a fun story, and it's an enjoyable story, and it has a good resolution. But I understand how people who have been invested in that vision of the future for 45 years, or whatever it was at the time, could be put off by that.
A little bit, but yes, I agree, and certainly there are plenty of fans who don't want to look at the Kelvin timeline at all.
Right.
You could say these are the characters as they're younger. By the time we got to see Kirk, it's where he is.
They're very young. And, of course, there is the inherent ridiculousness of, a 20-year-old cadet suddenly becomes captain of the flagship of the fleet.
Well,
but,
yes.
I'm willing to give him a pass on that because you got to put the pretty guy in the chair.
Right, right, right. Hey, when Nero's sending the drill down to Vulcan,
right?
Why doesn't Vulcan have any sort of defense fleet that they can shoot that drill?
Probably, but they were probably annihilated because that's a Romulan ship from like 100 years in the future.
Oh, so if they came, they would have been zapped.
Right. Because the Enterprise got there, I assume, after Nero destroyed Vulcan's defenses.
You're so wise.
And Starfleet was off somewhere. I forgot where. But
they were in some other sector, Tellurian sector.
Yeah, because that was why the cadets were called up.
They needed to get called.
They were the closest to Vulcan.
Well, that's always happens. We're the only ship in the quadrant, right?
Right. Yeah.
My favorite thing about Star Trek 09 is that the very first thing you hear after the music, you see the two logos,
right,
and then you see what just looks like a blur of color.
Yeah.
It looks, and it's the ship upside down because we're coming in a weird angle. It's like a Mark Rothko painting or something. And then you just hear the sound effects. And it's 97% the original series sound effects with a little bit of a tweak to it.
Yeah, the little bings and bongs and all that great
stuff. They're all over. They're all in the sound design. And that's such a smart move. It's so great. It's very reassuring to me. I mean, I used to watch the reruns of the original series at midnight when I was supposed to be asleep. If it was a boring episode like Alternative Factor, I would fall asleep during it, and it would lead me off to the land of nods. So it's really very reassuring,
Yeah. I that was one of the things that I didn't really remember from my prior time seeing it, and then tonight it was one of the things I sort of really noticed and appreciated. And you get, it's way intense in the first minute, but you get tastes of it throughout the whole film, the sound effects. And
the music is just dynamite.
In Star Trek 09, the music is fantastic. I have some complaints about Into Darkness.
Oh, really?
Music.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I want to
hear that. We'll get to that.
Well, later. I think we can. So we saw the first one, and I was elated. I was on a high. Oh, and I explained to you, we had just enough time to go to the bathroom and came back.
Right.
And I explained to you what Nero was doing for 25 years.
Yes.
So if you haven't read the tie-in comics or watched all the deleted scenes, he was on Ruripente on this version's
The Kelvin timeline.
The Kelvin timelines.
Yeah. Is that what we're calling it?
Yes, it's called the Kelvin timeline now.
Because I've been calling it the Abramsverse.
No,
but we can't call it that anymore.
It's no longer called that as of a few weeks ago.
Okay, this is official.
He's official. He's official, man.
All right, pay attention. This is official.
All right, so... By the way, I should let you know, we're kind of in the back of the theater. Like, there's a secret... If you ever go to the 68th Street IMAX Theater in Manhattan, there's a secret bathroom that nobody knows about, and that's where we are right now.
Well, we're not in the bathroom.
No, we're not in the bathroom. We're near the bathroom. We're near the garbage cans, actually.
We're not recording the podcast in front of a
urinal. No, we're in front of a bunch of garbage cans where we belong. So, So Nero was on Ruripente, and then there's other things in the comics... Where the ship, the Narada,
right,
was had Borg, had got amplified Borg technology.
And this is Nero's mining ship, the Narada.
Correct. And Spock's groovy little ship, which we call the Jellyfish,
right,
was designed a combination of the Vulcan Science Academy with Geordi LaForge.
Mr. LaForge.
Yeah, it's such a cool ship. I mean, there's a lot of really cool visual stuff in this film that is above and beyond, and that ship is one of them. It's really nifty the way it zips around, and
that thing is kind of spiffy.
And you know, when the chair is angled in a certain way with the window, it looks like the IDIC logo.
Oh, I didn't notice that.
I'm 97% certain that that is not a coincidence.
You think is that real, or are you just hallucinating?
I am going to do some research, but I'm pretty sure that
okay.
I
mean, that's a cool little Easter egg I didn't know about.
Yeah, well they don't celebrate Easter in Vulcan, but whatever they do celebrate, the Kazwan egg. So then we went to the restaurant.
I was going
to
say it's a Ponfar egg.
Right, those eggs are pretty
good. Those are great eggs.
So then we came back and Star Trek Into Darkness, and I have said time and again that I have misgivings about this film, but I got to say, when you know what you're getting into, and if you're lucky enough to see it projected in IMAX, it's actually pretty good.
All right, so here's my reaction to this. Now, I know a lot of people really don't like Star Trek Into Darkness. Now, I remember having seen this movie, and I saw it right here at this IMAX theater when it came out originally. And this was still coming off my somewhat cold feelings about Star Trek 09, which I liked, but I didn't think it was great for the reasons we talked about. And my reaction after seeing Star Trek Into Darkness was, okay, J.J. Abrams has redeemed himself.
We're backwards. It's like you're Lokai and I'm Bele. We're
right.
Totally
no,
reverse
and I,
of each
and
other.
I know you don't like Into Darkness
Well, I've changed a little bit tonight.
Into Darkness is a fantastic action-adventure film. It's fun as hell. There's not a dull moment in it. Since we're talking about it now, I'll talk about my complaints are primarily about the Star Trek aesthetic, which is that Star Trek Into Darkness does not really look or sound like a Star Trek film. I'll give you an example. In the first 5 minutes, we meet the guy who works for Section 31, whose daughter is sick. I forgot his name.
I forget it too.
And Khan's going to come and give him the blood serum to cure his daughter. And when we meet this guy, you know, he's like, he's taking a train to the kid's hospital, right, to visit her. And, you know, there's this little, like, tinkly piano score in the background. And in the entire history of Star Trek television and films, there's never once been a piano because it's space opera. You score it with a symphony orchestra.
I think Trillane played the piano on that. But that's all right.
That's not really a score, though.
Fair enough.
But I didn't really notice this the first time I saw it, but since I had seen it a couple times, I'm now sort of paying attention to that sort of stuff since I know it's going to happen. And I'm thinking, you know, is this Forrest Gump or is it Star Trek? Because I remember just hearing this little dinky piano theme, and then the piano comes back in the moment when Kirk has radiation poisoning and he's dying.
Mm.
And there's this little dinkly little piano theme again, and then, you know, it gets orchestral again later. And I remember thinking about that. That is the most un-Star Trek music score that I think I've ever heard. And I don't know why it bugged me so much, but it kind of took me out of it. And then we were also talking about the visual assault of the lens flare issue.
Yeah, it's a little... There certainly is a lot of lens flare in the first one. I think it's kind of groovy. I think they needed to reel it in on the second one. It was a little too much.
And so we talked about this a little bit before, but so rewatching the first one, because I remember everybody was complaining about this.
Yeah.
Everybody on all the nerds on the interwebs anyway. And so I remember watching the first one and I'm noticing them, but they're not really that intense. And I was thinking, did they, like, for the re-release, did they tone it down on the actual print? But then once Kirk and Scotty get back to the Enterprise, that's when you're really assaulted with it. And I was like, oh, okay. There's that angry cop shining a flashlight in my face for an hour.
Yeah, it's a little much at the end of the first one. It's certainly much in the second.
And then second, because the second one takes place mostly on the Enterprise, which is where most of those lens flares are in the Abrams aesthetic, it's a little more... And that on an IMAX screen filling your entire field of vision is a little aggravating.
Funny. I mean, I always liked his explanation for it. He said the future was so bright.
Right.
And, you know, there was also so much happening in the future that you couldn't see every corner of the frame.
Like, yeah.
That's why in the first movie you never see the Enterprise. Something in the Enterprise is always a little bit cut off. Either the
right,
back
you,
ne- of the
you never
nacelles.
See the whole thing. Yeah,
right.
there's no glamour shot.
Well, there are glamour shots, but they're very poised and stylized.
They're close-ups.
Exactly, they're close-ups.
I'm ready for my close-up now.
You know, it was funny. Seeing the two movies back-to-back with just a few minutes in between, it's funny that there are some moments of just Xerox copy, like the space dive to the drill and then the shooting across to the other ship.
I noticed there's a continuing theme of ropes that break. So, right, the first one, Kirk is on the drill, and then he jumps off and redeploys his chute and the rope breaks and his parachute goes away. And then in the second one, there's I forgot where it is, but there's another rope that breaks and somebody falls in a hole or something.
I mean, it is funny that in the second one there's an allusion to it. It's like, I've done this sort of thing before, and it's kind of a joke.
And then also the
ending is basically, we need a big blast to get away from the thing, and the music swells, and it's pretty much the same music cue.
Right. I appreciated in the second one that there were more nods to the historical elements in Star Trek. Like, there's a mention of, like, Christine Chapel, and there's a mention of Mudd's planet.
And the Gorn. He's like,
And the Gorn.
He says,
which doesn't make sense, because they haven't met the Gorn yet.
That's not necessarily true. This is the genius of the original 09 film, that everything after the destruction of the Kelvin means that...
Everything's different, yeah.
Anything could be different, so maybe they met the Gorn earlier, and maybe the Gorn are good guys now.
Okay.
The Gorn always were potentially good guys. It's just that...
Right. They were put in an unfortunate situation.
Yeah. So now the Gorn, the line is Bones says, I once delivered
emergency C-section on a pregnant Gorn.
C-section on a pregnant Gorn.
But the Gorn are lizards, and lizards lay eggs.
That's why it was an emergency.
Oh, okay.
You know. All right. The other thing that's sort of like just watching them back-to-back is... And this is sort of there's two big problems that I have with Inner Darkness, is that the first movie kind of revs up where the characters are, and then when the second movie, all the momentum kind of moves back a little bit, and then it revs up again.
Yeah, because Kirk gets busted down, and then, you know, they have to kill Pike so he can get busted up again, which is what happened the first time around.
Right, and it's killing me that I can't talk about the third movie yet. You're about to see it for the first time in
just
a few minutes. But
Jordan has the secret knowledge.
I'm biting my tongue. Now, the other thing that bothers me about Into Darkness is, and it's right there in the word darkness, I think that it was a misstep to make the film about false flags and I just don't like the premise of the film that much.
I had completely forgotten that Section 31 shows up in Into Darkness because I remembered the plot, you know, because there's always a corrupt admiral. Admirals in Star Trek are always jerks.
I'd
forgotten that it was
corrupt.
She was just
tough.
Yeah, all right. But I had forgotten that it was actually a Section 31 plot, and that's the first time, that's the only time Section 31 has been seen with the TOS characters.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that the movie itself is, I think, a little bit unnecessarily confusing, because there's two bad guys. There's Khan and there's John Harrison, and then he's Khan, and there's that whole debacle, which I think was not the smartest.
You just would have called him Khan from the start.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I just, you know.
Well, on the other hand, but it's that's a good reveal. It's a surprise that he's Khan.
It should be. It should be.
But of course,
cares.
Everybody knew Benedict Cumberbatch was Khan.
Every time I've seen this movie in the theater, nobody has ever blinked.
Right. But the intent was that that was going to be a surprise reveal, I think.
And it didn't really work. But then the other thing is, you know, so you have Peter Weller's Admiral Marcus is the baddie, and Khan is the baddie. You don't really understand what their schemes are. It's very confusing. You have the torpedoes with bodies in it. There's a lot of plot. It does make sense. I think if you really study it, if you shut off all the lights and get in your room and really think.
No, I think I didn't have problems with the plot or the motive. And well, of course, but I have all the background knowledge of having, you know, seeing Wrath of Khan and knowing about the augments and all that
nonsense. If you're new to this, I don't think that's going to work.
If you're new to it, the exposition, I think, is a little thin. But, you know, you're kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place because you can't, you know, thicken out that exposition without annoying everybody else.
And
you'd have to slow down the whole film. And it's a fast film.
There are only a few talky bits in there.
And speaking of which, and that brings me to another complaint, which is not unique to the Abrams Star Trek films, but is a very common complaint with kind of action-adventure films of the last, let's say, maybe decade and a half, which is that the action is cut so fast and with so much shaky cam and all the Dutch angles in Holland that it makes it makes action scenes sometimes incoherent, and you're not sure you can't even tell who's punching sometimes,
right? And I think
who's getting punched, and I understand the reason why they do it, to kind of amp up the energy of the scene. But if you can't actually follow the story of the fight, and because a fight scene is like a little mini movie in itself, and if you can't actually follow the story of the fight, and especially on something like IMAX where it's really in your face and loud and taking up your entire field of vision, it makes it difficult to follow. And I have that complaint about a lot of movies.
I think by and large, Abrams does a good job with it.
It's a lot better than movies I've seen. Abrams doesn't go overboard with it, and I've seen movies go really overboard. But it was still more than I would have liked to have seen. I would have liked to see less shaky cam and less super intense cuts. You know, take a cue from Stanley Kubrick. Just do one camera on a tripod with a candle.
I can't wait to return to this very topic after you've seen Star Trek Beyond, because there are some changes, some for the good, some for the bad. We'll see. But just getting back a moment to the plot, I do think that there is sort of like a pretzel logic plot to Into Darkness, and it does. There's a lot of like nastiness to it. I mean, the name of the ship is called Vengeance, and there's two moments in the film where two of our beloved characters are just overtaken by vengeance.
Right.
And Pike dies. Kirk is ready to let Scotty quit because he just wants to kill.
Right.
And eventually Spock does talk him out of it, but he almost doesn't. And then later, when Kirk dies, Spock is ready to just kill.
Well, remember, before that, there's also Kirk, when they're on Kronos, is beating the hell out of Khan after he's taken into custody.
That's all right. That doesn't bother me.
After he surrenders. I understand, you know, for Pike, here's one punch, but he goes after the guy.
Well, because he doesn't fall down.
Right.
It's his own damn fault.
And then Spock's just sort of standing there, and it's Uhura who says, Captain,
calm down.
Take it easy, buddy.
You know, it's funny. It struck me today, Uhura and Kirk really have an interesting relationship.
Yeah.
Obviously, they met. He was trying to pick her up in a bar. But there is a lot of respect between the two of them. I mean, there may be some people who feel that he doesn't respect her or there's weird vibes. But I think it's in there in the writing and the character. The actors do a really good job of riding that fine line of where they can be.
I love, you know what
like
it is?
Very real with one another, although they are professional.
I love Kirk as the third wheel.
Oh, those scenes are great.
You know,
so funny.
Spock and Uhura arguing in the little pod, and Kirk is supposed to be in command, and it's just sort of there. And you know, Kirk's reaction when they're having an argument is fantastic.
Yeah, you know, that's exactly the type
of
scene.
And it's a great scene because now he's the commanding officer of this flagship. You know, at the age of 12, and now he's in a situation where he's not in control. And he can't really do anything.
Those are the scenes,
fantastic. That's a great fuel for comedy.
Yeah, and those are the scenes that I think do really well in Into Darkness that are undercut by Admiral Marcus and sort of this weird conspiracy theory, false flag stuff. And again, I'm very excited to speak to you after you see Star Trek Beyond, okay, because it's relevant to what we're talking about.
Okay. Yeah, and I don't know if Marcus's motivation is really... I don't know if I buy it 100%. Because
it's all twisted and weird. And then the movie ends with that dedicated to the fallen of September 11th, which you know, is a nice gesture, but it's a weird thing for a movie weird made so long later.
And yeah, it was 2013
it's
something?
It's very strange, and it's like not a one-to-one connect. Like, the only person who was making the connection... was the I think this was Robert Orsi. It was kind of his thing, and very, I don't know. Well, the good news
that
is
thing
this.
Was weird.
The good news is this. I come away from this screening today. I already loved 09. You were mixed on it, and now it seems like you like it more. You already loved Into Darkness, and I was kind of meh on it, and I still have some real misgivings, but I like it a lot more as of tonight.
Okay, good. So I was correct. That's all we needed to know. Yep.
All right, so listen. So we're gonna take a pause now, and we're going to go watch Star Trek Beyond.
Right, we have to do one thing really quickly before we go into Star Trek Beyond.
Yeah, what's that?
I need to know who would win in a fight between the Gorn captain and Armus, the oil monster who eats Tasha Yar. Now, keep in mind, Armus is basically a pile of goo.
Yeah, he's a hefty bag.
But he has fearsome telekinetic powers.
Well, that's the thing.
And the Gorn is a giant lizard.
Yeah, if his telekinetic powers are primed, then the Gorn is toast. Keep in mind, a didgeridoo with rocks killed the Gorn, you know, or at least knocked them down. So the Gorn, although a great guy,
right,
is Armus, the hefty bag, is going to destroy him.
Okay, I think that's a reasonable and sound analysis.
Unless the Gorn takes him by surprise.
Okay.
If he has the element of surprise, then Armus is a shredded hefty bag.
But what would the Gorn do? I mean, you can't just...
Bite him?
I mean, you can't, but they... Because they tried firing phasers at Armus, right? You can't punch him because he's liquid.
He would take him from behind and bite him and like at his jugular vein. He would come from behind and just like rip him to shreds.
But he's goo. He doesn't have a jugular vein.
He must have some circulatory system keeping his goo intact.
I guess. I don't know.
He's... And that voice. He has the funniest voice.
Who did that voice? Do you know?
I don't know.
I wish I knew. That up. All right. We have to go to Star Trek Beyond, but real quick, hold on.
Yeah, and in 3D also.
Three-way fight between original series Spock, Data, and Seven of Nine. This is a tough one, I know.
I think Data is stronger.
I think he's quite strong, but Vulcans are strong, and Seven's got Borg strength, so they're all very strong and combat ready.
Yes, but Seven of Nine has gotten her ass whooped a few times. I've seen
That's
her
true.
Get knocked out, and Spock can get. I'm going with Data.
Okay.
Also, Data has he's faster reflexes.
That's true. He does have super fast reflexes. Yeah. On the other hand, Seven has her neural Borg implants, which give her spatial acuity and allow her to have perceptual abilities that perhaps Data does not have.
I mean, I love that she... I do like watching her fight, and she has some pretty nifty moves.
I like her watch her do her anything.
You like to watch her in the astrometrics lab doing science.
That's right.
Right. Yeah. I got it. All right. Well, listen, I love talking about Seven of Nine, and we're going to do some more of that. But now it's time to go beyond, and this is a treat for me because I'm not going to lord it over the 200 people inside that I've seen the movie already. I'm going to keep it to myself. But I'm part of the excitement for me is to see how the audience reacts because I know what's coming up. And I'm going to be cool about it. I'm not going to nudge you or I'm not going to poke you and say, watch this scene. But I am
going to... not going to turn and yell, spoiler alert.
Right? No. I'm not going to say, look what happens next. But I am going to see what the audience vibe is, and I'm excited to see what I pick up that I didn't notice the first time, because I can be a dullard sometimes and not notice something.
Yeah, okay.
Case in point, not realizing that it was Sulu's misstep that saved the day.
Right.
So, all right, cool. So we'll talk to you all again in a few moments.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
This is Engage.
Engage.
The official Star Trek podcast.
Energize.
And we're back. Oh my God, I'm exhausted.
Oh my goodness.
It's late. It's
what a wild ride.
It's like after midnight now.
It's 20 after midnight.
These are not short movies. Oh my God. Having seen Star Trek Beyond twice, I can say this is so much fun. I really love it. And even though, if you were just listening, I came away saying, I like Star Trek Into Darkness better than I remember. 2 minutes into this, I'm like, oh, this is everything that you want Star Trek Into Darkness to be. It's so upbeat. It's so vibrant and alive and jolly and action-packed. But
I like the word jolly. That is an apt description.
So, Frito, I didn't even really ask you. We just left the movie. We just used the washroom. What did you think of Star Trek Into Beyond? Star Trek Beyond.
First, thank you for telling everybody that I just took a leak. Second, I enjoyed it immensely. I think of the three new era movies, this is by far the best one.
Wow. Bold. Better than the first one. Better than 09.
Better than the first one. But remember, I thought Into Darkness was better than the first one, too.
I know. So you're crazy on all of these.
That's true. I am severely crazy. Mm. But I thought it was great. I don't think it was a perfect film by any means. And so if you're interested, I'll complain a little bit about it.
I want to hear it, yes.
But it is a fun ride. I think... in terms of plotting, it's a little more straightforward than Into Darkness was, and we talked a little bit about the perhaps unnecessary complexity of that story.
Yeah, I feel like number two is so confusing, and this one is almost, to a fault even, really simple.
It's right, like, it's very bad guy. It's very straightforward. There's he's bad, and he has an interesting motivation, which I don't think we have seen really explored before in terms of Star Trek villains. And he's got an interesting background.
Yeah.
And it was really fun. I think the movie definitely does not waste any time. I don't know how do you want to get into spoilers on this or
oh, yeah,
keep it
yeah.
vague?
Right. We can dive
spoiler
right in.
Spoiler alert, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes. But you know, what really got me this time was like really noticing the minutiae. Like,
right.
You know, the uniforms are a little different. When he wears his jacket, he's got the little zipper, and the zipper has the Starfleet insignia.
Oh, that's cool. I didn't notice
well,
that.
Well, you notice that when you're in the second row.
Right.
By the way, we moved from the fourth row.
Yeah, so we were really close up.
Yeah, because there was...
And I'll tell you, and I don't think I mentioned it last time, but one of the things that bugged me about Into Darkness was about the uniform, seeing Starfleet guys with like military-style hats parading around San Francisco. And that was weird. Like, you never see Starfleet guys with a hat with an insignia on it.
Hmm.
And that was bizarre to me. But speaking of which, there's always been this weird conflict. Remember the early seasons of Next Generation, Picard was always like, Starfleet is not a military organization.
Right. Yeah.
Which, of course, is complete nonsense, because, of course, it is. It's just that fighting is not their primary purpose.
It's like karate. You only use it when you have to.
When you have to.
Yeah.
But it's interesting to see, and because there have been fan discussions online about this, about, you know, has J.J. Abrams militarized Starfleet perhaps too much?
Mm.
And the uniforms in Into Darkness kind of irked me for that reason, you know, although they still refrained from going as far as to having people salute. You never salute, you never see salutes in Starfleet, which is interesting. And I like the uniforms better in this picture. I think they're more Starfleet-ish. And visually, I really enjoyed what Justin Lin did as compared to Into Darkness.
What were some of the? I should say, by the way, we watched this in 3D, and I hate 3D.
Yeah, I'm not a big for live action. I'm not a big fan.
Okay, Shrek, it's fine.
Yeah, like in Pixar stuff in 3D, that's enjoyable.
Okay, because it just makes everything darker.
It makes everything darker. Also, we were really close, and 3D has kind of a fatiguing effect sometimes. Like after 90 minutes, my eyes are kind of twitching all over the place.
And we had three movies in a row.
Yeah, the first two were in 2D, so that was fine.
But sure.
After an entire day of watching movies, a 3D on an IMAX screen from row two can be a little exhausting.
But let's talk a little bit about sort of the visual differentiators between the two Abrams films and Lin, because I'm curious.
I love that Justin Lin is not afraid to do establishing shots. You look at the Abrams movies, everything, and you mentioned this a little bit, you know, every shot of the Enterprise is kind of a close-up.
Right.
You know, there's really, they kind of eschew the glamour shot of, you know, the big nebula background, and here's the ship. But even so, you look at the space station in this and beyond, and there's nice establishing shots, you know, showing the city and really sort of creative artwork of this. There's a space station which is on the inside of a sphere, so which is cool. I don't think that we've seen that in Star Trek before.
We
haven't seen DS9. Of course, was a ring, but that was not.
Sphere. It's like it's ring world, but a sphere.
Right.
And it's like Rama from Rendezvous with Rama, but like 360 of them because it's a sphere.
Rendezvous with Rama is cool.
but what I love about this is that the cities are upside down on the side,
right.
On the ground, which means that in the very center, there's a gravitational wackiness, which means everybody can fly.
Yes. And that is something that visually could, if you do it wrong, could be very confusing and difficult to understand. But it was done well.
Yeah.
And it made sense.
There are a couple of really nice money shots of when they first get to Yorktown of just like swooping around and seeing the citizens.
And it's great.
In this utopia of like, oh, here's a businessman beaming
it's
somewhere.
It's the kind of thing that I loved seeing in the Star Wars prequels, which are otherwise pretty terrible movies.
Right.
But are visually gorgeous.
Coruscant is a cool looking place.
This wonderful imaginative artwork, and you know, you turn the volume down and it's entertaining to look at it. And this has the advantage of being both beautiful and a really good and fun.
And this
movie has
monorails in it too.
Monorails.
There's some really cool looking monorails. So yeah, Yorktown I think is a real win because also
is great.
It's the cities and it's kind of sleek, but then you see the bowels of the system and there's water
now,
and.
So one thing I like is in several Star Trek movies, but including the last two, they managed to completely destroy the Enterprise every time. And in this one, we also get that, but like in the first half hour of the movie.
Get it over with.
Get it over with, blow up the ship, and then figure out how you're going to get us out of the situation.
What did you think of Krall's swarm ships, the bees, the murmuration?
Those were cool. That's definitely, I don't think we... Aside from something like the Borg, we've never really seen kind of a swarm before. And if you looked at the history of the Borg idea in Next Generation, the original idea of the Borg was that they were supposed to be insects. The Borg drones were supposed to be insect-like creatures that had like a swarming behavior, but that was too expensive to do on TNG's budget at the time.
Sure.
So they made them cybernetic humanoids. And so this is kind of an interesting callback to that idea now that you can do anything with computer animation. It's a lot more interesting to see this kind of swarming drone enemy. And you think about, you know, every Star Trek battle you've ever seen, you know, it's one ship versus another ship or maybe two other ships.
Yeah.
You know, in DS9, you got, you know, a fleet over here and a fleet over here, but it's still you're basically looking at, you know, a Navy war game, but in three dimensions instead of two.
This allows for a lot more speed and for a lot of really cool visual perspective stuff because from afar... and what does the Admiral say from the reaches of space? There's no you can't center yourself. Well, she has this great poetic line.
Right, I already forgot it though.
But you know what I'm saying? It was like you can find no center when you're in the reaches of space. But anyhow,
something like
from
that.
Afar, they look tiny. But then when they're slamming into the hull and they pierce through a corridor, they're like these giant little...
And it's great as, you know, just sort of a terrifying image. You're looking at afar, you're seeing... You can't see the individual ones from afar. You can only see the cloud, like locusts from afar is just this menacing black cloud that's approaching slowly. And then when you get close up, you're looking at these individual ships that are, you know, kicking everybody's ass. And it's great. There's never been a Star Trek enemy... quite like that.
And they
mention it too. You know, Spock has a great line like, you know, our weapons are not designed for this type of enemy.
And they're like, oh yeah, they aren't.
I want to ask you about sort of the emotional cores plural of the film, right, which is the relationship. There's the Spock Bones stuff, which I think is, for longtime fans, that's the star of the show. It's so great.
Everybody loves Spock Bones, and you gotta love Spock Bones because they're the best frenemies in the 23rd century, and they're great. You know, that's the kind of the classic relationship that you see in TOS.
He calls him Leonard. I don't think in the show did he ever call him Leonard before.
I don't know. That's a
interesting point. In a friendly, caring love, he's like Leonard. He almost is like Leonard. You know that I love you. You know, it's almost like that.
I love the moment when Spock is injured and near death, and he's with Bones. And Bones makes a joke, and Spock actually laughs at it.
Yeah,
here's a testament to the skill and the direction of this movie, is because that is a moment that could have easily been really alienating. Spock laughing, that's ridiculous.
Right.
But the way that it's done is actually makes perfect sense, and it really works. Is a testament to what Zachary Quinto was doing and what I think the writer and director were doing.
And it's been
that moment lands perfectly.
And it's been established by now that's like, yeah, this guy has emotions. It's just that
he's half human.
And the other sort of, you know, everybody's sort of, in the story, there's a lot of like, people break off into pairs. And then I really love the relationship between Jayla and Scotty.
Yeah, Jayla really is funny. Great, yeah.
She is great. She's a cool new character.
Yeah, I like her a lot. And she was really interesting. I love, you know, there's kind of a classic trope of like, you know, the real scrappy female character who's always going to surprise you in the next scene.
Yeah.
And that can get, if you do it wrong, it can get a little tiresome and predictable. But Jayla was not like that at all. She was great all the way through. She had fantastic ideas. And she was... There's always been Star Trek characters that were kind of along for the ride, and it's great when there's someone new who actually really becomes part of the mission and is actually
helpful.
She's
incorporated well. Like her ideas are incorporated, and she's quickly part of the team. You know, it's pretty nifty.
And that's great because there are a lot of throwaway characters in the history of Star Trek that are
like Carol Marcus from Star Trek Into Darkness, who it's implied is she's staying on the ship and then she just disappears, and then that cool I think
she has a scene at the end at least when she gets winked at by Kirk.
Yeah, but she's not in this movie at all.
No,
and then
because she would have nothing to do.
And the cool science officer 0718, the cyborg dude with the bald head, right, who I really wanted to see again, he just vanishes. But that's okay. Now, the other big emotional moment, and this is something that I didn't, you know, we did another podcast episode where we reviewed the film with some other critics. And although I said it's spoiler zone, you can say what you want, it didn't come up au naturel, and I didn't force it. But I'm going to talk about it with you, which I think is the most emotional moment that I'm going to have in a movie theater this year, which was seeing the photograph.
Yes.
Did that take you by surprise?
Yes, it did, and that was a fantastic moment.
Yeah, really smart, I think. Really great.
And, you know, it reminded me of, in the first two movies, every time Nimoy shows up, the audience claps.
Right.
And we saw this with a room full of Star Trek, an IMAX theater full of Star Trek fans. They've obviously, the vast majority of them have seen the first two movies already, so then you know that Nimoy shows up.
Still,
everybody claps when they show up. And when this thing came out, I don't know how much you want to say about it, if you want to make it only a semi-spoiler.
Semi-spoiler,
but this,
okay,
you know, a really lovely third act kind of moment with Spock, and this thing comes out, and it was by far, of course, this was a new movie to everybody, but it was still a much stronger reaction, and a wonderful reaction in the room.
It's, I didn't see it coming, and it really touched me the first time, and it touched me the second time.
It's so brilliant an idea. I never would have thought of doing that.
Yeah, yeah, because we already knew that Nimoy was on board, but like seeing DeForest Kelly and Jimmy Doohan is like, oh yeah, that's there they are, you know, it's all part of the thing. It's very sweet. It really is. Now, we're talking about only the good things. Let's talk a little bit about some of the things that annoy us. But you know what? I'm going to hit pause before we do. Let's take a moment to bask in the glory of all the things we liked about it, and then we can gripe and grief a little bit in just a second.
Okay.
to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
Welcome back to Engage.
Engage.
The official Star Trek podcast with your host, Jordan Hoffman.
You are, after all, irrational.
And we're back. So it's a big love-in for Star Trek Beyond right now because we're still high from seeing it. But I, it's the best thing that's happened to me in 2016. there are still some things that aren't perfect. My beef is I do get what Krall wants, but it's kind of because I've seen movies before.
Right.
You know, I know what he's going for.
It's always tough when there's a villain who basically wants to destroy the world.
Yeah, he's, you know, like Space ISIS.
Right.
He's just a nasty guy who doesn't like unity.
You get it if the bad guy wants to steal the treasure or something like that. But when the bad guy is basically a genocidal maniac, you have to start from the premise that, okay, this guy went mad. So why? Why is he crazy? And because there's not going to be a logical reason for someone wanting to destroy the world. They have to be a crazy person.
Right.
So then the motivation for that has to come from their backstory. All right. So what was it that drove this guy insane? And I think he has an interesting backstory.
It's a little hazy.
It's a little hazy. We know that he was a Mako.
Which is cool.
Which is very cool. A nice nod to Enterprise.
And he fought the Zindi War.
Yeah, so this guy's a soldier from, you know, back before Starfleet, when there actually was an Earth military. And he gets sort of, he gets made obsolete, right? And he gets pushed into this role, is sort of semi-military, but not really. We're not expecting you to fight unless you have to.
Yeah.
And he doesn't really know how to do it. He doesn't know what his place in the world is anymore. And then... unjustifiably, he feels abandoned, and then what ends up happening to him, and I won't give it all completely away, sort of pushes him over the edge. There is, and so since we're sort of getting into the complaints of it right now, just purely from a filmmaking perspective, I thought the transition that Krall has from his alien-looking skin to when he's just Idris Elba...
I feel like there's something left out.
Something's felt left out, and I could follow it because there's some exposition dialogue that I was paying attention to. It's very easy to miss that this is the same guy.
Yeah.
And I didn't quite understand. I sort of understood that he had some alien technology that was keeping him alive by sucking the life out of his prisoners. But I didn't quite understand how that tied into the
rest
of it.
Which is very original series, isn't it? And it's a salt vampire, you know?
Vampire. It is a very TOS thing. And they've done similar ideas in the other shows, too, I think. It seemed kind of out of place. And I don't quite understand how that technology... sort of resulted in his body transforming and then becoming human again.
I mean, he just said
they have the technology to extend life, but it also makes you a lizard man.
I mean, yeah, something
he
like
left that.
That
part out.
And I didn't get it. And, you know, of course, the reason he's a lizard man is because we're not supposed to know that he's a human until the big reveal.
Right.
Comes.
Why he has to change his name, we don't know either.
Right. I mean, put him in a suit or something so you don't see his face. That would have done it just fine. So I don't know if there was stuff that was cut that would have made that more sense. And the other big complaint I have is the first act, blow up the Enterprise battle, just goes on and on and on, too long.
It's a little long. And I think
there's a lot happening during this battle, but I feel like it could have been 10 minutes shorter.
Go ahead.
And also, part of that might have just been, you know, it's the beginning of the movie and my eyes are still adjusting to the 3D and we're at the IMAX in the second row. And, you know, it's very Latin. We're in the second row sitting directly in front of the subwoofer. And every time something blows up, you know, it's blowing you back in the seat. So maybe there's just a little fatigue there that you would not get watching this in a normal theater or at home. But even so, I felt myself getting kind of worn out with this battle.
You know, it felt like I was watching like Saving Private Ryan instead of Star Trek. And I'm like, okay, you're blowing up the ship. I mean, it takes 20 minutes to blow up the ship.
It's a big ship. It's lots of good defenses. I like that sequence. I will say, though.
It was wonderfully done. Everything about it was.
The use of gravity was good. They're walking on the walls. But they do that in Into Darkness also, which I've kind of forgotten.
And I love the gravity sequences in Into Darkness. Yeah,
those might actually be a little bit better.
I love, because it took the movies to really get to the point where you stop pretending that there's gravity in space.
Right.
You know, because I think it was Undiscovered Country was the first time we ever see the gravity generator fail.
Right, right.
On the Klingon ship, right? And yeah, the cool pink globules of blood and stuff.
Purple blood, yeah.
And then, you forget about that because it's expensive to do those effects. But I love the gravity stuff in Into Darkness. And they do it a little bit here on the ship, but they also do great stuff with gravity on the Yorktown station.
But the battle scene in this movie that I thought went on a little too long. I think the first one's okay, so I disagree with you there. Okay. But it's the second one, because they go back to the Enterprise when it's like totally busted down.
Right.
And then the saucer flips over. Feel like that
And that
was...
reminds me, I loved kind of the callback when the saucer crashes. It's the same shot from Generations when the Enterprise D saucer crashes.
Yeah.
And Data yells, "Oh shit!"
Yeah.
And that's great. I thought that was I don't know if that was an intentional callback, but it looked like exactly the same shot, which I liked.
Let's put it this way: they were aware. They've done their homework. Simon Pegg has done his homework,
definitely.
But I just feel like that's the second. There are a lot of action sequences. The movie's mostly action,
right?
And of all the action sequences, it's that second one, which is kind of in the dark, because it just feels like they're going backwards. And I know why they do it. They have to go get the radio beacon, and
they get the
girl out to get the little MacGuffin and whatnot. But
The doodad.
But it just sort of strikes me as... It's just...
They could have done that without leaving the ship first, is the thing.
Maybe you're right.
Yeah.
Maybe that's what they
should
have done.
Because, they kind of crash, they leave, then they go back, they get the doodad.
Kirk and Chekhov should have just stayed.
Yeah.
Because they leave and then they just walk there.
Right.
Like they don't do anything else.
I think they like beamed out to random places.
They have
or something.
The scene with the.
Oh no, they were in escape pods, and they all landed in different places.
But Scotty could have still done the escape pod because he's got a great Kelvin pod. They call him. He has a great Kelvin pod moment. But you know what you do see, and I think this is the best use of it ever in Star Trek. Red Alert. The best use of the Universal Translator.
Yes. Yeah, and I had meant to mention this. So we actually see, for the first time, a Universal Translator that makes sense.
It really does. But we don't hear it from her point of view.
Right.
We have to assume it's just the same in reverse.
Right. And so we see this alien woman speaking her language with a Universal Translator device that is then speaking English to us.
Yeah, it's like on her lapel.
Right. For the entire history, for 50 years, it's always been hand-waving that, well, of course, the Klingons are speaking Klingon, but there's a universal translator.
Right.
So why do their lips say English words?
Right, no, it's never quite...
It's storytelling, it's a conceit, get over it. And I thought it was fantastic and lovely that they were able to really make it make sense at this point and do the audio so it's not distracting. And so, you know, you hear the English dialogue and it was great. And of course, you know, it takes, you can't really do that in a TV show for obvious reasons. You got to invent the language the actor has to remember all the fake words and stuff. It takes time to do that kind of thing.
It's one of a number of little niceties that are in this
film.
But
yeah, I thought that was a wonderful, wonderful thing, the way they handled it. And it would have been so easy to just do it the way they've been doing it for 50 years. And they said, no, let's do this one
once. There are a lot of like little clever beats. Like I noticed this time when the closing credits are, the font kind of resembles the TNG font.
It looked like the early TNG credits.
Yeah. Which is nice. No, what did you think about the Beastie Boys? First of all, do you think it's going to piss people off?
I mean, first of all, I love the Beastie Boys. So, you know, obviously they should be popular in the 23rd century. I loved that moment in the first one with little kid Kirk stealing the car.
Yeah.
And playing the Beastie Boys. And I don't know if he's playing the Beastie Boys or that was just the soundtrack.
I think the implication is that he's playing it in the
car.
Yeah.
And so, he was playing it because he does say good choice when
Lana plays the Beastie Boys. He obviously knows
the song. I thought some of the editing with the swarm battle and the Beastie Boys was maybe a little too cute.
It's ridiculous and it's silly, but
it's fun and it's enjoyable.
I think it kind of works.
And I think it kind of works.
It's
like
Mad Max Fury Road kind of works.
I think for Star Trek, it was just a tiny, tiny bit over the top, but I don't care because the rest of it is great.
Well, I will. Yes, it's the dumbest thing in all of Star Trek, but it's also pretty great.
I don't know. In Star Trek V, they met God.
But this is ridiculous because they beam the Beastie Boys to the Yorktown, and the Yorktown blasts it out.
Right.
And it's just the beat where they all go, whoa!
Yeah.
And it's
and
like
everything blows up.
A wall of fire
and
explodes.
That was exactly the moment when I was like, okay. But I only cared about it for about half a second.
Well,
I was like, that was pretty cool.
My mind split in two, and the dominant part of my mind was like, this is the greatest thing ever.
Right.
And the recessive part of mine was like, there are some Star Trek fans that are just going to drop dead of a heart attack now. So, but they're no fun, those people.
Yeah, true. it's a movie.
Exactly.
Chill out a little bit. Enjoy it.
So listen, we got to wrap it up here soon, but... it's funny because, and as I mentioned on the last episode, I even said, well, this is the last time we're going to see these characters on the big screen and maybe the last time we see Kirk, Spock, and Mons. Now it looks like they're going to make a fourth movie.
And that's fantastic.
Yeah, and it's going to involve, allegedly, Chris Hemsworth as George Kirk, either through time travel or a wormhole or something.
Interesting.
It's going to be Kirk and Thor.
Thor Trek.
And I think that they're going to be a great kind of father-son bromance thing happening. I think it could be really cool.
That is very interesting. Now that this is on record, when the actual movie comes out and it's completely different, I'm going to make fun of it.
Right. No, I mean, this is what they say is happening. It will be sad, though. I got to say, having now watched three Star Trek movies in one sitting, Anton Yelchin is really going to be missed.
Oh, man.
His Chekhov is such...
He was so fantastic. Every
really
single
great.
Line.
He just kills it. He's just terrific. And it's... It's just a tragedy that he's...
Victor Charlie.
Yeah. in this movie...
As good or better than Nuclear Wessels.
Really is. It really is.
And he was fantastic. It was so sad and sudden and ridiculous. And they had a nice dedication for him at the end.
Yeah, yeah.
Which, of course, they would, but it was nice. And
there's that moment at the end when they sort of are Kirk giving a toast and there's a reaction shot of him, which I suspect was probably edited in
later.
Yeah, it's really sad. So they'll do the fourth one, and you know there'll be no Chekhov, and they'll have to figure out why there's no Chekhov. But I think that's the right thing to do. I think to replace the actor.
No, you can't replace a guy like Anton Yelchin because then everybody would be comparing him the way that they are comparing Anton Yelchin to every other Chekhov.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, he had two really good movies and killed it and defined the role.
Yeah.
And or three good movies actually. And it sucks.
Yeah. But we don't want to leave it on a depressing note. We want to leave it on Star Trek Beyond. 2016's been a bit of a shitty year. This is the only good thing, the only universal good thing. No, I won't say that. But it really is a lot of fun. I liked it. I liked it just as much the second time. I was not bored for an instant.
It's very, very rare that the third movie of anything is that good. And I liked it. I liked it better than the first two, which is unheard of in movie franchises. I got no complaints. See Star Trek Beyond at a theater near you.
Awesome. And I can't wait till the Blu-ray comes out and we can find all these missing scenes that we've been talking about with Krall.
And figure out what happened with that guy.
Awesome. Frito, thank you so much for spending the day with me, the day into the night.
Oh, man. It was my pleasure. And thank you for inviting me on your show.
Engage.
Which has hosted such luminaries as Adam Nimoy and
Weird
Josh
Al.
Horowitz and Weird Al Yankovic.
Josh Horowitz.
Yankovic. And now here's this schmuck from Brooklyn. Who doesn't know about anything?
You were the guy to come with. This is great. A lot of fun.
It was an absolute blast, and thank you for inviting me.
All right, and we'll see you all next week. So long, and live long and prosper.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.